and before saying anything else, thanks to Peter Watson for all his work in arranging meetings, the secretary and most of it. And thanks to Helen Tate, who's now retiring as treasurer to be taken over by
Adam Wagner,
yes, I was looking for him. Just for name. That's right, yes. We have apologies from Ian Nimmo-Smith, Martin Gibson and Pamela Morris, and
thank you, Ted. Let me first of all, as usual, this is a sort of an attendance slot. It's a heavily abridged version of what we used to have, but you will need to hear. Total attendance last year was 88. Every meeting had double figures of speakers, which is, I think, the first time that's happened. So that is probably our best year in that respect. As always, suggestions from venues and speakers are particularly welcome. We have, as you'll see in the treasury account, £200 in the bank, so if anyone's got any ideas what they might like us to do with that, we could just keep it for emergencies, of course. And of course we have our website, so all the latest details will be on there, including the .mp3 files that we've got of the speakers. And I'd like to thank Ted for chairing the meeting. I don't think I've ever actually thanked him all these years. So,
well, it's a pleasure, Peter.
Oh, well, thank you, Ted. And I'd also like to thank Helen, because she's been treasurer for a long time, and I think when she became treasurer, we were bankrupt. So to go from being bankrupt, I mean, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, there was a point where this group had no money at all, and from that to £200 in the bank, and the profit of £1 per member is, I think, very good. So, thank you, Helen.
Well, if I recall, I think the £200 was rescued from Django's.
No, I think it came from scratch.
It did?
Because it was the money was tied up in the estate, in Rob's estate.
Right.
So we couldn't access it.
Uh-huh. Okay, yes, that was the case.
So the nice thing with a bank account is you don't have to worry about the treasurer popping their clogs. We can still access it. Well, we hope we can, anyway. We haven't got the passport, so perhaps we can't. But anyway, there we are.
Right, so the financial situation is as stated in the reverse of the minutes, and it's an appropriate point therefore to welcome Andrew Conlon, who will the sort of the intractable problems to do with bovine tuberculosis. Andrew's got a very varied background. He probably needs it, and we look forward to enjoying the fruits of your talk, actually.
It's been a really successful project, for me at least, in that it's brought together some really nice classical statistical methods and mathematical modelling, which is the area that I'm interested in, and some reasonably advanced and modern methods of statistical inference, And all of these things have actually generated some outputs which are useful, not only interesting, but actually useful for policy makers as well. So it's paying for the work, it's actually sort of, we've earned the money we've got out of the government by making this project. So fundamentally, what I'm going to be talking about, the model that I've developed, is to try and understand the efficiency of our current method of testing and controlling bovine tuberculosis. So I'm just going to start by giving you a very brief introduction to the background of bovine tuberculosis. So, horribly complicated disease. It's the sort of thing that people recommend you not to get involved in modelling before you take jobs, because it's complicated biologically, it's divisive politically, and I think one of the major reasons for that is that, like all bacterial infections, it's a very mysterious disease in many ways. There's lots of the fundamental epidemiology and even the life history of infection of the host that we really don't understand very well. Like human tuberculosis, it's a chronic infection, so there can be a very long time from animals being infected and then being diagnosed with showing symptoms. And that makes it really difficult to tie down what is actually driving transmission and what's the sort of focus and causing problems. This is made even worse for bovine tuberculosis because we have an extensive test and slaughter program going on. We're constantly removing animals from herds when they're detected to have bovine tuberculosis well before they develop any symptoms. So the average farmer is in the frustrating position that they're seeing large amounts of their animals being removed, they're having movement restrictions placed on their herd, which makes it more difficult to run their business, but they see very little of the impact of the disease.
May I ask, if an animal in a herd tests positive,
yes,
what happens to the rest of the herd?
It depends.
Yes,
so only... So when I say test and slaughter, only animals which are test positive are removed from the herd. And you continue testing the herd until you think you have all of the infectious animals.
So once an animal tests positive, that intensifies the testing on the herd?
It does actually, it does, and that's what I'm going to get on to discussing. Actually on the next slide.
It stops movement.
Yes, so once infection's detected, movement restrictions are put on the herd, and it goes through these regular 60-day tests until it clears one or sometimes two clear tests. And that, I'll come back to why it's one and sometimes two later on, because it's a very, quite complex system. Just to wrap up the introduction, there's one thing you can't really ignore if you're talking about bovine tuberculosis, and that's the role played by our black and white striped friend, the Eurasian badger. Hugely controversial, and yet the nature of the relationship between bovine tuberculosis in badgers and cattle is really very poorly understood. So at the largest, most expensive scientific experiment ever, in the randomized badger culling trial, which basically told us that badgers are involved in transmission to TB, but culling doesn't help in terms of reducing incidence in cattle. So I think the badger issue is really, it's divisive in more ways than just the political aspects and the animal rights aspects. It's also divisive in terms of the fact that it's drawing our attention away from other factors and other processes which actually might be just as important or more so in the resurgence of TB in the UK. So we've seen over the past 10 years a year-on-year increase number of infected cattle herds, and we don't understand what's driving it. Badgers could be part of it, badgers could be all of it, but there are other aspects to TB control. In particular, what I'm going to focus on in this talk is the fact that the diagnostic test that we have for TB is actually quite poor. It has very known limitations. So the test, it's worth just going over the biology and really a biologist in one sense. So biology is interesting and it's important. The test for tuberculosis is it's basically the same mechanism of the skin test that you have for human tuberculosis. So we take some purified protein from the bug, you inject it into the animal, and you come back a few days later to see the size of the reaction. Okay, so it's measuring an immunological response that shows that you've had past exposure to the bacteria. Now that would be fine, but unfortunately there's lots of related mycobacteria, especially avian strains, which animals may get exposed to, which could give a false positive reaction. And that's why we have what's called a comparative test. So we put in some avian tuberculin and some bovine tuberculin, and it's the difference in the two reactions that tells us if we've got what's called a reactor, a positive animal.
Another question, as between, say, avian and bovine, are cattle susceptible to be infected by avian?
No, not as far as we know. But they may
give
a sensitizing result. Yeah. It may sensitize, it may give them
An immunological reaction.
Immunological response, yeah. But they wouldn't develop any form of disease.
Okay. So it is as specific as that, just to the species?
So actually, M. bovis is quite a broad spectrum of bovis. So that's the problem with the badger. Basically anything warm and furry can get infected with bovine tuberculosis. But not with feathers, no.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So when we say, I wouldn't be categorical about that, actually. The avian tuberculin strains are adapted to birds. Just as the human tuberculosis strain is adapted to humans, but humans and cows can both have, so people can get M. bovis and cows can get human tuberculosis, but they won't necessarily be able to transmit when they're infected. It's messy, it's a bacteria. So because we've got this, because it's a comparative test, we can essentially choose our sensitivity and specificity some extent, and in fact that's what's actually done in practice. So they have what's called the standard and the severe interpretation of the test. So for screening, you use the standard interpretation with a high specificity so that you don't place movement restrictions on herds unnecessarily. Once you detect infection, and once that infection is what's called confirmed, so if you find laboratory confirmation of visible lesions in an animal, then you switch to the severe interpretation. And you try and increase the sensitivity by trading off some specificity. Okay. Now, exactly how much of a trade-off that you get, we don't really know, because we don't have a gold standard diagnostic test for M. bovis. So one of the things that we're trying to get a handle on this model is, what is the sensitivity and specificity of the test under these two interpretations as it's applied in Britain? They're trying to get population average estimate of those values. Final thing, probably the most important thing, which I should have mentioned at the beginning, is the fact that this test is measuring an immunological response. So animals must have been infected for enough time, and the disease must have developed to a state that they've actually generated this response. And that means if you test animals too early after they've been infected, you won't be able to detect them. And this is captured in this idea of an occult period. Now, from animal challenge experiments, we think this period is from between 20 to 90 days. But an animal challenge is very different from natural transmission, and it could be longer. So that was really the key thing I wanted to try and estimate using this model approach. Because, at least in a model, that occult period is really going to control the amount of hidden or missing infection that we've got in the herd that's potentially contributing to onward transmission from herds when we lift those movement restrictions.
And you put 364 days there as well?
Yeah, so my friend Ellen Brooks Pollock, friend and colleague, has some models, some transmission models, which don't include herd structure, have estimated a cult period of up to a year, which seems incredibly long, actually. So So, but it just adds to the uncertainty. All right, so that's the properties of the test. What's also important is how the test is used. And we've already actually talked about this optionally from questions. There is this link between how much disease we find and how much we test. Okay, so there's maybe a little kernel of insanity there somewhere. And that the more likely we think we are to find animals, the more we're going to start testing for them. So herds are routinely tested at 1, 2, 3, 4 yearly intervals based on the past history of infection within the local area. So this map, the blue areas are 4 yearly parish testing intervals, so most of Scotland, a lot of England, and the going up to the red, PTI1, annual testing herds. So these are the real TB hotspots. So this could equivalently be read as a map of incidence of TB. And we see it's very spatially clustered in these regions, but it's also growing outwards. So we see that the PTI1 areas are surrounded by PTI2 areas. And if we look in the top north of Wales, which is PTI4 at this time, so this is a snapshot between 2002 and 2005, I think it's the period that we're fitting the data to, fitting the model to. This is now all annual testing. Okay, and that's because as part of one of the trials to introduce badger measures, the Welsh government decided to just test everything, and they discovered there was a huge amount of infection in this PTI4 area.
So PTI4 is basically the default?
Yes. So back in the 1980s, when TB was pretty much eradicated, every herd in the country was at 4 yearly testing.
What's the criterion for going from 4 to 3?
So there's hardly any 3-year
exactly.
ones. So it's this small area down yeah. here. So the criterion of shifting is slightly crazy. Mm-hmm. It's basically based on an estimate of local incidence, which is calculated using a rather odd formulation that DEFRA knows.
Mm-hmm.
It's not based in any way on epidemiological risk.
Yeah. It's because according to that map, either you're on 4 or you're highly likely to jump straight to 2.
Yeah, in practice you start at 4, breakdowns are detected, and pretty soon you're going to go on straight down to 2, and then you're going to go to 1. Mm-hmm. These regions of PTI2 are really very transitionary. And you quickly go on to PTI1. And given the fact that TB is a chronic disease, it's a slow rate of progression, it's difficult to detect those first breakdowns, it makes sense that actually by the time we realise there's a problem, we're constantly catching up in terms of changing the control.
Isn't that map similar to the map you would get just of plotting the population density of cattle? This
yes.
is the area where people keep cattle.
Yes, so, yeah, this is the highest cattle yeah. population density. It's the highest badger population density. It's the highest sort of average temperature, so various environmental correlates are also high in these regions. So, yes.
So it's not really surprising that on
it's
the
not
east coast of the Highlands of Scotland you don't test very well, because there aren't actually many cows to test.
Well, there's a lot of cows in Scotland. but there isn't TB. And so TB is technically, Scotland rather, is officially TB free. Which means they only have breakdowns with English cows with TB. Okay, so they've got constant seeding coming in from cattle movements from Ireland and England. And they have a few breakdowns, and the breakdowns from CAR as well. We'll come back to talking about that later. But the density of cattle can actually be quite high in Scotland. There are large herds in Scotland, but there isn't a TB problem. So it's not just that that's where the cattle are.
Interesting little island down near the horizon there.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know the reason for that, actually.
Because there's not, I mean, there are plenty of grazing grounds along that whole stretch of coast. and the terrain is all much of a muchness as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly two different processes going on here in the spread. So there's local contiguous spread, which is actually probably mostly through movements of cattle, actually, because movements of cattle are mostly local. But occasionally you do get long movements, which is why you can pick up these little clusters which then start spreading out.
I mean, could this possibly have been an infected import into a herd?
Almost certainly, yeah, yes.
It wasn't spotted at the time.
So this band here, I think that band here, a lot of those are the result of foot and mouth and restocking farm. So a huge movement of cattle, taking TB with them, and then following that, starting to break down to new areas. So that's been looked at in quite a lot of detail. So cattle movements are a very important part of TB. Okay, so the model we're going to look at is modelling what happens in a herd once infection has been detected. Now, herds in PTR1, 2, and 4 are going to have a very different past history of both exposure and testing. So the PTR4 herds will be tested much less than PTR1 breakdown. But following the imposition of movement restrictions, they go through a very regular series of tests. So there will be short interval tests of 60 days and then follow-up tests 6 to 12 months after movement restrictions have been lifted. So this is in some ways admitting that there may be an issue with the test. Okay, so skip over this actually. This came out of what's called the Problem Herd Project, and it was it came out of this realisation by DEFRA that they were spending a disproportionate amount of money on a small number of breakdowns. So there were breakdowns which were consuming a large number of resources in terms of testing and compensation. And there was a workshop to determine how you could actually classify these problem herds in a more rigorous way. And they came up with these two definitions, it's actually before I was involved in the project, to do with the duration of the breakdown and probability that the breakdown is recurrent, the probability that there's infection found after it's allegedly cleared. So let's just consider what these numbers actually mean, just to get an idea of what these problem herds are. So this is the distribution of breakdown length, so the duration of time that herds are under movement restrictions. So a lot of herds, most herds, will clear the breakdown within 2 weeks. So that's what they need to clear the minimum, and a lot of them will do that. There's this very fat tail, and about 29% of breakdowns will be prolonged under our definition. Perhaps more interesting is the time to recurrence. So 40% of breakdowns nationally will recur within 2 years. Okay, so that's a huge amount of recurrence, and in fact it's one of the major risk factors to having a TB breakdown is that you've got past history. In itself, that suggests that perhaps we've got a problem with persistence of disease. We're leaving infection in the herd when we lift movement restrictions. And that's what modelling work that I've been doing is to try and estimate. Now, the way I came at the problem was in thinking about what's known as persistence measures. So these have been used in ecology and epidemiology to try and get a handle on what the probability is that a disease will go extinct. So the most famous work pioneered by the great statistician A.M.S. Bartlett was looking at measles, where he postulated an idea of critical community size. Or more generally, he just showed that the probability of extinction reduces as the population size, the host population size, increases. Now, subtlety with these persistence measures that we estimate from data is that what they actually tell us about is the balance between the local probability of extinction and the rate that infection is being reintroduced. So for childhood infectious diseases, if we think of the number of cases of measles in Wandsworth, for example, there's going to be a local probability that it goes extinct at the end of the epidemic, but there's also this chance that you'll get new infections seeding in from the surrounding boroughs of London. And this relationship can actually be used as the basis to infer information about the biological processes that have been going on. Some recent work has done some nice work estimating spatial coupling, and also more ideas about the life history of the disease, the duration of immunity, and for pertussis, for example. So we see exactly the same sort of relationship of resistance with population size or by tuberculosis. So there's the possibility that we could use this as a target to try and parameterize the models to make inference on some epidemiological models of bovine tuberculosis. So this is a result by, again, Ellen Brooks-Pollock, which demonstrated that as herd size increases along this axis, the probability of passing two clear tests falls up to about herd size of 400. It's messy after that just because most herds in Britain are less. So this is a nice paper, but it's only one definition of persistence, and something I learned from work that I did in childhood infectious diseases is that it actually matters what your definition of persistence is, and different measures can give you complementary information. And in fact, these definitions of problem herds, which came out of this workshop, to me seem like perfect statistical measures for the persistence of bovine tuberculosis. So one tells us about how persistence of disease is affecting the duration of the breakdown. The other, on different timescales, is telling us something about recurrence. And the different values of these potentially give us information on the timescales of latency and the rate of transmission that's going on within the herd. And that's the basis that we're hoping to perform some inference on an epidemiological model. So, starting from Ellen's work, we drilled a little bit deeper into the data to look at how these persistence measures scale with herd size. Okay? So some grumpy faces. This is my lovely figure for submission to Nature. Don't look unhappy. What we're concentrating here is the solid lines. We'll come back to the shaded things later. Just try and block them out of your memory. Each of these panel plots is a relationship with herd size. So I've binned information on breakdowns. And then I calculated the proportion of breakdowns in these herd size categories, which are prolonged or recurrent. And I further split them by parish testing interval, PTI 1, 2, and 4. Okay? So what I'm doing here is I'm classifying the breakdowns by their past history of testing, but also it's a correlate roughly to their spatial location and their past history of exposure. So we'd expect a very different background rate of introduction of disease in these different PTIs. Also, as I talked about before, there's this idea of confirmation of breakdowns. So the purple lines are confirmed breakdowns, the green lines are unconfirmed breakdowns. So confirmed breakdowns, we actually know the bug is in that herd. Unconfirmed breakdowns, we don't. So it might have been started by a false positive. Or it could have been the infection. Okay, so what do they tell us? Well, I mean, I think these patterns are really quite fascinating. I think there's a huge amount of information here. If we look at the proportion of prolonged breakdowns, the first thing to notice is across PTI 1, 2, and 4, it's confirmation status, which is really important, or really the essential thing in separating out the probability of the duration that you're going to be under movement restrictions. Once you've confirmed, you move to the severe interpretation, you start removing more animals. You're not necessarily removing more infection, though. And that's why it's interesting that the proportion of recurrence, confirmation makes no effect at all. So confirmed and unconfirmed breakdowns have exactly the same rates of recurrence in PTI 1, 2, and 4, though the rate of recurrence is much higher in the PTI 1. Other target measure we've got here is the number of reactors that we pull out at the test when we disclose the breakdown. And this is just a crude measure of effectively the herd level incidence. And it's a very important target actually to get right in the model, which is why it's here. And we see that the number of reactors is greater in confirmed breakdowns. Again, that makes sense. We're removing more animals. But also it's a stronger dependence on herd size, okay, which is kind of interesting. plan, but something that really we can understand without developing a dynamic model, because the way that we test is changing dynamically with the amount of transmission that's going on in the herd. So we need a model which captures both of those things, that balances and tensions, to try and understand essentially what is the efficiency of testing. So at the centre of this is how much missing infection is there, what's it contributing to the rate of recurrence? That's the really key question I'm interested in. And what DEFRA were interested in, obviously, why we were funding to do this work, is they want to know if we have breakdown herds that we think are likely to become longer recurrent, what can we do to reduce that happening? What interventions are going to reduce the duration and the probability of recurrence? So, like I said, I argue we need a model which can link persistence testing and transmission. But we also really want to do that in a simple enough way that we can make some inference in the parameters of this model, and that's what we tried to do. And the starting point was herd level models of transmission, which were first used in New Zealand quite successfully, a really nice model developed by Nigel Barlow, and takes the compartmental approach. So we're just looking at transmission within a herd, and we split the herd into animals according to how they react to the skin test. Okay, so we've got a lot of compartments here. Animals begin susceptible, they become infected at some rate, and they then are undetectable to the skin test, so in my language, a cult. After a certain latent period, they become reactive, so you can detect them, but they're not yet infectious. And then finally, they become infectious and detectable. And then, if you leave them in the herd long enough, they may become what's called anergic. So this is slightly horrifying. They are so infected, massively infectious, but their immune system is so compromised that they're undetectable. We don't believe this happens in the UK, because if it did, we'd see animals with multiple lesions. So that's something that we're putting in a box and sending off to an island.
You put infectious further along the chain than susceptible and reactive, but is it possible for an animal to be infectious, even though it's unreactive, for instance?
Very glad you asked that question, because in fact, very nice model, the Barlow model. The parameterization was a bit ad hoc, but it was parameterized to New Zealand data. And since then, there's been one experimental study which suggests that animals which have been challenged with a low dose of Embovis actually shed bacteria in the first 20 to 60 days of infection. Okay. So potentially, there could be some amount of infectiousness in this occult stage.
And also in the following stage.
Well, if you then take those animals and keep them, they shed less bacteria, so there's this peak. But then
later they'll become infectious again.
No, you might not. Yeah, so they might have done the damage, you wouldn't spot them with the test, and they stay in the herd. And then they potentially pop up later.
Yeah. So you could in fact clear a herd which is carrying unspotted infectious animals.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And the ordering of events and the evolution of infectiousness and detectability could be dynamic. We don't really understand that very well at all. So, in order to make some progress with modelling, I made an exceptionally brutal assumption. So the model, final model that I settled on for this work has only the occult and reactive stages. So it's essentially a susceptible infectious epidemic model. Animals are potentially infectious as soon as they're infected and are infectious until they're removed from the herd. The only latent period we've got in here is an occult period, which is the one that we're interested in estimating.
So you basically assumed maximal infectiousness?
Yes. So this is really brutally simple epidemic model. Only complexity really in the epidemic model comes from how we model transmission. So if you've got any experience of these transmission models, you recognise that this first term is the rate of cattle to cattle transmission within the herd, so it's a mass action term. However, we've added this extra Q parameter, and what this does is it measures the difference between it's called density and frequency dependent transmission. So this is the sort of thing you should never mention to a group of epidemic modelers, because they will argue for about an hour about which one's right and why. They're both probably wrong, but they sometimes tell us something that's useful. And in TB models, the original Barlow model assumes density-dependent transmission, which means effectively the reproductive potential of TB increases with herd size. And some later models assumed frequency-dependent transmission, where it's invariant with herd size, because they believe in frequency-dependent transmission. The Q parameter lets us move between these two assumptions and actually try and estimate things. Okay. So, very simple epidemic model. How do we want to use it? Well, we want to simulate a sequence of tests before, during, and after a breakdown. Okay? So actually the complexity of this model isn't the epidemic model. It's modelling the testing system used in Great Britain. So we've got the standard and severe interpretations, confirmation process, and we've got what we described in words a little bit earlier, the sequence of tests. So this is, believe it or not, a highly simplified version of the workflow trees which animal health practitioners use to decide what tests they're going to apply to a herd. So we start with surveillance. Herds are routinely tested at the parish testing intervals. We've also got ongoing surveillance of a sort by slaughterhouse, so if an animal has lesions, you test it and see, and that can trigger a breakdown. Once breakdown is triggered, you have the short interval test at 60-day intervals. If you clear them, follow-up tests at 6 to 12 months. If you confirm any of the reactors, so you manage to culture the bug, you move on to the severe interpretation, and you have to clear one test at severe and one at standard to clear the breakdown. So that's what I meant by you have to clear one, sometimes two tests. Okay?
But so you could go around in circles on the red arrow there at severe.
Yes, you could just keep going forever and ever and ever. And in fact, some herds do. And at a certain point, they just get fed up and they kill the whole herd, and they find that they're all got TB. So the system can break down, and there are examples which show that the system does break down occasionally. Okay, so I've got 12 model parameters. I very much like simple models. 12 is making me a bit twitchy. But I'm still impressed that I've got it down to 12, because it's a very complex system I'm trying to model. And in context, there are models out there in the literature which have pages and pages of parameters which can never be inferred or parameterized. So we hope that this is a nice balance between telling us what we want to know and being able to actually get some information. Most of these parameters related to testing rather than transmission. It's really the testing system we're trying to model to leverage some information about transmission. So actually fitting the model is actually a wee bit tricky, because writing down a likelihood for this model is not easy. It's a very non-standard model. There's delays in there, it's a dynamic model. So the method we've used is one called approximate Bayesian computation. So this is an approximate method, but essentially what we do is we replace the likelihood with a Monte Carlo estimate of the probability of matching simulations of data within a fixed tolerance. Okay, so that's the technical description. What we actually do, and the way I think about it, we just try a bunch of parameters and we see how well our simulated epidemics match our target metrics. So the trick there is getting the metric right. Okay? So we're going to be fitting to persistence measures, to the reactor distribution, to a few other things which are important. And given that metric, we can just use a loose tolerance and then slowly increase it. And in principle, as we make that tolerance smaller and smaller, we should converge towards the true superior distribution. And although it's an approximate method, it lets us do a lot of the things that at least mathematical modelling would fit the method of fitting model. It fits a model for us, that's guaranteed, we'll get the best fit that we can. I mean, essentially we're using goodness of fit metrics to fit the model, so by definition it's going to fit well, hopefully. It gives us an idea of uncertainty in the parameter estimates, also the sensitivity of the model to different parameters. It allows us to generate predictive distributions and see how different interventions would affect the epidemiology of the model. So we're back to this figure again, and now we can look at the shaded intervals. What these are called shaded density strips, so the intensity of colour at each point is the probability of the simulation having a value at that point. So pretty much across all of the target measures, the final model does a really good job of matching this empirical relationship. We do a slightly less good job in matching the reactive distribution. Now this is really, it's fundamentally important to include this because it's a very important constraint on the parameters, and it's disappointing that we can't get quite enough reactors in the confirmed breakdowns in PTI1. There's probably some very good reasons for this, not the least of which is that we don't explicitly have counter limits in this model. In this model, a breakdown will be started by one effective introduced. Now, you might expect in reality that a breakdown will be started with a much more clustered amount of infection. And that might be one of the reasons we're not capturing this. The reason we can is we've got this really strong constraint on the PTI4 breakdowns. And it's the PTI4 breakdowns which are really controlling the story here in some ways. Because they're placing, effectively, the maximum amount of recurrence, for example, that could be explained by within hair transmission. Because they've got the lowest rate of infectious pressure, so the lowest amount of infection and introduction rate into herds, they really place a very strong bound on the amount of recurrence that can be explained by this infection.
Can we just have another look at that?
Yes.
Except for your top row, for small herd sizes, the model seems to be rather consistently underestimating what the data show.
Indeed, yes, that's a good point. Yes.
You know, the model gives a very narrow band, which in general is outside your polygonal confidence band for the data.
Yeah.
And it's as if your model actually wants to predict a result of zero, very small herds, whereas your data are not doing that.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, and in fact, that's precisely one of the reasons why that Q parameter was introduced. So originally I fixed it frequency dependent information, and with that model you just can't get anything going on. Yeah, it's an interesting point. Yeah, it does work much better than the large hairs. Or it's the large hairs that are fixing or limiting simulation. That's a good point.
The match is pretty good on the top row, though.
Yeah. I mean, one of the next things to look at is actually how the demography of the herd, so the structure, age structure of the herd, might be important. And for the small herds, it's going to be critical, because these herds have a huge turnover, actually. And at the moment, I'm just sampling that turnover from an empirical distribution. And it could be that I'm moving infection off the herd too quickly in these small herds.
Are there distinctions between dairy cattle and beef cattle?
It's interesting. No. No, there isn't.
Because there will be totally different rates of turnover in the two.
Yeah, yeah. It's really surprised me. So if you separate out beef and dairy, of course there's also a big difference in the herd size of meat and dairy herds. And beyond the herd size effect, there didn't seem to, there's no other difference between meat and dairy herds. That was surprising. Actually, that it's also consistent with what came out of the logistic regression and models. It was there, there's a conflation of herd size and herd type. Skip over that. This is just showing that the ABC method can produce some stereo distributions, or not stereo distributions, approximate distributions of parameters, which are fairly good for this model actually. They're in parameter regions which seem sensible or consistent with biology. I don't want to go into labour the details, or just sort of take home messages. First is a transmission coming out as non-linearly density dependent, so somewhere between frequency and density dependent. So the within herd R0, so R0's the epidemiologist's favourite concept, it's the number of infectives we'd expect if we introduce a single infective to a completely susceptible population. So now a measure of the maximum reproductive potential of the disease, we see that it increases with herd size. So this suggests, according to a model, that there's more transmission going on in larger herds. It's not just that they're bringing in more infection or there's more difficulty in removing the infection, there's actually more transmission going on as well. So if you were wanting to move to a risk-based control policy of TB in the UK, then herd size is going to be a very important factor in that. So that's an important message to the policy. So what policy actually want? They don't want to see the model, well, it fits quite well, parameters are sensible. They want to say, well, what does it actually tell us about controlling these trenches? How efficient is the current system? What can we do to improve it? And just going to consider two different scenarios here. I think a multitude, but these are really quite informative to what the model is saying. One, we'll eliminate the severe interpretation of the test. So we'll see how much benefit are we getting for that extra increase duration of tests, breakdowns that we see for confirmed breakdowns, and we'll also say what happens if we develop a perfect test, detect all infection in the herd, what's it going to do to recurrence? It's a wee bit disappointing. So this is for pairs testing interval 1 tests, we've got herd size along this axis, we've got the relationship for prolonged and recurrent breakdowns. These graphs, and I've introduced this new idea of the infectious burden, so that's the probability that there's at least one infectious animal remaining in the herd when movement restrictions are lifted. So under the current regime we see the infectious burden increases with herd size up to about 17%. If we eliminated the severe interpretation, we'd increase that slightly, not very much. We'd see a dramatic drop in the probability that breakdown is prolonged, very little difference from the current. Even more surprisingly, the perfect test eliminates infection within the herd, reduces the length of the breakdown, but has no impact on the current. And that's because in this model, the current is being driven completely by reintroduction. And that was actually quite surprising to us. We were hoping for something in between. In fact, we have suspected that this missing infection could be driving the current, but the model says no. Okay, so I tried to persuade you this evening that key to modelling persistence of TB is this dynamic interaction of testing and transmission. The model suggests that recurrence is driven by reintroduction, the implication of which is that actually all the time and effort that we're putting into improving this diagnostic test isn't actually going to help very much in reducing the probability of breakdowns recurring unless we can reduce the rate at which infection comes into the herd. Now of course there's something, that's something which is missing in my model, so that's a major limitation of this approach. It's a way of assessing the efficiency of testing on a herd by herd basis, but it doesn't tell us how much that missing infection is contributing to the rate of reintroduction to other herds. So as soon as movement restrictions are lifted, a farmer could shift all of his dodgy animals and sell them to someone else, and they could start successive breakdowns.
Have you, so to speak, assumed that the problem of occult infection does not exist for new species? Or does this include the possibility of occult presence?
So in this model, there's a 17% chance that we've left infection there.
Right.
But so we can't quantify to what extent that feeds back into the rate of reintroduction, so from other herds, so yeah, those 17% from the other herds that are trading. And we need a network model to ask that question.
So that actually, occult presence is a factor to be balanced against reintroduction?
Yes, it's likely to be correlated in some way, but we can't answer that question with this model.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things which, one of the major criticisms which nobody actually piped in about, is that I've taken the standard book on TB modelling for cattle and I've thrown it out by getting rid of this long latency period. So TB is a chronic disease. You would expect infections to increase with time of infection. So we also fitted a model with the same, with the Barlow structure that includes the latent period. And we had quite a few issues with it. So the parameterization we get out, there seems to be an identifiability problem between the occult and the latent period, as you might expect, given this data. Also, the occult period that we're estimating is of the order of about a year, which doesn't tally with the experimental evidence that suggests it should be much, much order of magnitude shorter. However, we look at the predictive distributions for the two models. We see the Barlow model, because it's got this very long occult period, has a huge probability of leaving infection in the herd. But yet, when you introduce the perfect test, you actually increase the probability of recurrence in a large herd. And that's because in order for the model to fit the patterns of recurrence that we see, we have to have a much higher rate of reintroduction. And the perfect test is very good at detecting it. So you actually get a slightly increased chance of recurrence. So despite, in some sense, this is a little bit reassuring in terms with very different model structures. Recurrence is still driven by reintroduction. And biologically, it seems this is coming from the constraint I've talked about earlier, from those PTI4 breakdowns. Those really place a strong upper bound on the amount that a occult infection could be contributing to recurrence. On the other hand, these two very different models can produce equally good descriptions of our target measures. Okay. That's a wee bit worrying. In particular, because there are models, network models, which include cattle movements using the cattle tracing system data, which essentially ignore within herd dynamics, ignore the dynamics that we've modelled as a project. And they either assume that there's a very long occult period or they just ignore it completely. So what this work suggests is that that difference, so separate choosing between these two models, could actually have very different consequences for the contribution that occult infection has to cattle movements, so the contribution rather than cattle movements has to transmission. And in fact, those two models could give you a completely opposite picture of the relative contribution of cattle transmission in badgers. So what we're hoping to do in the next project that DEF was just funded as far as to start taking these within herd models and work up to put in the global network structure and hopefully meet the network modelers somewhere in the middle. So thank you very much for listening to the question. And hopefully you've got some more difficult questions. Thank you very much.
Do you expect the avian TB to behave the same way as bovine?
In what sense? In no sense, probably, actually, yes. The distribution, not quite sure what you mean, but the most, I think one of the key issues is the geographical distribution. So you'd expect that the density of avian strains is going to be very different in different herds and in different parts of the country. And in fact, in parts of Europe, there isn't the same number or diversity of avian strains, and the skin test works a lot better. And they've got much lower rates of TB. So you could see variants. So the test, effectively the test sensitivity and specificity could vary geographically. We don't really have a good handle.
Why I asked this was because the age of a bird and age of a cow are quite different.
Oh yes.
45 days to how many years this cow's in, this, I don't know.
It's something to look up when I get home actually. I don't think the birds have disease as such. I suspect it's a commensal organism of some sort, gut bacteria.
So for this 4-year cycle, how many cows, same cow will be, how many times have you been tested?
That's very interesting. Very interesting. Very nice paper was done by Andy Mitchell a few years, actually looking at the number of times an animal is tested, and huge proportion of animals are never tested in their lifetime.
That's why it's falls with the herd size as well, because the same animal wouldn't come in the next cycle.
Yes, that's the thing. Yeah. So even if you miss, even if you leave a cull infection in the herd, those animals aren't there the next time you test.
Would the cows recover from TB?
No, they wouldn't.
Like,
no.
They wouldn't at all. Like people.
Another interesting question. So, human TB models have two very distinct progressions. So they have what are called fast progressors and slow progressors. Fast progressors develop disease. Slow progressors, in fact, most of us in this room are probably slow progressors. We've been exposed to TB. But we're not affected. Now that doesn't mean that at some point later in our life we become stressed, our immune system drops, we could get full-blown tuberculosis. Same thing could happen with cancer, we don't know. And in fact one of the things we suspect is there might be some animals which develop lesions and become skin test positive very quickly, and there might be others which are exposed and then just don't show up in the test until much later. In fact, Shamble is an excellent example that it could happen. Well, he's a data point or an anecdote, depending on how you want to look at it. But does anyone remember Shamble? He was a holy cow, basically. Mm-hmm. He lived forever on this island and suddenly showed up age 10 to be a reactor.
There was a big fuss about it.
There was a huge fuss because as a reactor he has to be killed. Yes. The argument was made that he can't possibly be affected, he's been on this farm his whole life. Of course he was actually bought from the farm and passed through another farm which have a TB history. I shouldn't have said that with the recording actually. If you look up the ear tags, you can check. There's a colleague of mine that's done that. And he did pass through a herd with a TB problem, so he could have been affected. But that was a huge length of time in terms of even the traditional models assume that you become detectable within a year or two.
Is there any particular organ that tends to exhibit the symptoms of TB in cattle?
Lungs, basically.
Like humans?
It's pulmonary, yeah. Although, and this is where one of the subtleties with animal challenge and natural infection can come about. You'll see lesions throughout the nasopharyngeal head area. You'll mostly see lesions in the lungs of infected animals. But when you experimentally infect animals, you drop the bacteria down the nose, so you see lots of lesions in the head. So that might be a reason you see that early bacterial shedding. It might be different. Then again, in a lot of the natural infections, you do see lesions in that part of the as well. So it's mysterious.
Is it spread by the Cotton?
That's a good question. I'd like to know that. It's assumed to be aerosol transmission. If you come out to the vet school and have a look at the cows, I have a little trot around the paddock at lunchtime. And they do lick each other a lot. You'd imagine that snout-to-snout contact is probably very important. Showing that experimentally is almost impossible. It's interesting, I mean, it's one of the fascinating things of the badger cattle question. It's assumed, transmission's assumed to be aerosol in cattle, but in badgers, it's assumed to be through urine. So badger to cattle transmission is assumed to be urine, because badger disease is assumed to be in the digestive system more than the lungs, and so they think it's urine on the pastures which then leads to transmission. However, there's also evidence that badgers are regularly jumping about in cattle feed troughs and rubbing noses. Cows, so
I mean, yes, I was wondering what
there's multiple opportunities for transmission.
Don't they develop any immunity once they get one? Because the recurrence seems that they does not immune.
Well, we wouldn't know really because we kill the cows. And I mean, that's another thing. We pull out the animals which are displaying an immune response. Now, they might not have develop disease. You could make lots of arguments, and the immunological, the pathological evidence just isn't there. Again, because it's just so difficult to do experiments. You can do challenge studies, but so the VLA, our collaborators, did a really nice transmission study. They got some naturally infected animals, put them in pens with susceptible animals, and left them for a year. And a few were infected, a few of the wrong animals were infected, but the sample sizes are tiny, and you've got to spend a fortune housing these animals for multiple years to see a few transmission events. So it's a real problem, which is why we hope that, well, I guess it's, I mean, in some ways it's a problem, in other ways it's a job opportunity for me, because trying to get the biology from the population to them is really one of the few things we actually can do. And I'm a lot cheaper than keeping a cow for a year. I think we worked that out in the costing. Postdoc for 2 years is a lot cheaper than one cow for 2 years.
Is there somewhere that we can read about this in more detail online?
It's just finished. We're currently submitting this week.
If we put a link to you as the IDC, might we find something?
If you look on the DEFRA website, actually the end of project reports should be up there.
So go for DEFRA?
Yes. The interesting, juicy one that actually works is probably being held until we get the publication.
Right.
And so it might have to wait and see.
It's being tested to see if it's infected.
Yes. Well, it's being tested to see if it was sticking.
I'm totally bleak. I mean, what you presented is a thing getting worse and worse as the years go by. I mean, is there any light? Could you see any light at the end of the tunnel?
I think the great hope is vaccination. Mm. And in fact, that's what our next project is on, looking at how good a vaccine has to be, given the transmission model that we have, to reduce the burden of testing. Vaccination is the most efficient method of controlling disease, and then you don't really have to worry about the badger if you're vaccinated.
Yeah.
The problem is, of course, we can't export any animals to Europe anymore if we vaccinate, because the vaccine interferes with the skin test.
Well, as I remember reading, when this was coming up a couple of years back, if you vaccinate an animal, you destroy, you destroy its disease-free status.
Yes, exactly.
So it, you know, it's no longer qualified, so to speak. Even though it's probably much healthier, it's more likely to be healthy than an animal that you haven't.
You would hope, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the other danger is if the vaccine doesn't work, you could effectively be vaccinating them against positive test results, and then they could be, so you could get a building problem transmission. And there is a zoonotic risk. So I've glossed over that. So humans used to be routinely infected by bovine tuberculosis, but it was through drinking infected milk. So with pasteurization, it's actually very little risk, even if we just stop testing and let TB run rampant. We probably start to see cases in farmers and abattoir workers, but I mean, that would be one option. If you look at it, because it's, in some sense, it's not a health issue, either for the cows, really, or for humans. It's an economic issue. How can we control the disease in such a way that farmers can still make a profit, can still trade freely on the open market? Very odd thing. It's a very odd thing with animal diseases. It all comes down to the economics.
How close is a vaccine to being developed? I mean, there isn't really effective, a human one, so...
It's been... So if you ask Lynn Hewitson... top guy at the VLA vaccine development, the vaccine's been coming in 5 years for the last 15 years. So they have a vaccine for badgers. And that is licensed. So you can vaccinate badgers if you can get close enough to one. They haven't quite worked out how you could actually deliver it. That's a bit of a question mark. And they don't really know if it works or not for badgers, but it's safe. So they could potentially have a vaccine licensed within 3 years, but that's not the difficult part. The difficult part is convincing Europe that the vaccine works in such a way you can still detect infected animals. So they have what they call DIVA tests now, which distinguish infected from vaccinated animals. And so demonstrating to Europe will need to show that DIVA test works and can be used for exporting animals. And they probably also have to make the argument that the vaccine is actually going to make the situation better rather than worse.
Isn't there a slight, almost logical problem there? The effect of vaccination is that it stimulates an immune response, which means that infection of bacteria is in some way neutralized by the immune system. That does not mean that the bacterium is physically eliminated necessarily.
No, certainly not.
Therefore, you could have the bacterium neutralized but still present and therefore give you a positive test.
Yes.
Solely as a result of how the immune system of the animal reacted.
Yes. So they do have axillary tests other than skin tests. So they can tell.
Might it actually be impossible to develop a vaccine which would, so to speak, result in a negative test for a vaccinated animal?
Oh no, they have a test that works.
Oh,
they can do that. Yeah. No, it's the blood test. It's the gamma interferon test, which is more expensive.
Right.
So it's too expensive to use for screening.
Right.
But it can differentiate, at least as well as the skin test, between vaccinated negative and vaccinated infected animals.
Right. So you could have an infected animal where the infection has been neutralized by the immune response due to vaccination. And that would be distinguishable from an infected animal where the infection has not been neutralized.
Neutralized is maybe a bit strong.
Well, yes.
so it's not necessarily...
Rendered in.
Yeah, I mean, depending on the date you ask an expert, you might say what they call sterilizing community is possible, or it's not. In fact, from our point of view, or from the epidemiologist's point of view, if you can stop transmission happening, that's enough, actually. And that's actually more important, because you get the effect, you get the control effect, you get the herd immunity. It's one of the things we hope to work with them on. It's just a question of, there's a huge gap between immunological data and understanding the clinical dynamics and linking that into population models. It's a big area at the moment in terms of theoretical research, but yeah, the parameterization is statistical.
And in fact, the tubercles themselves are the body's method of rendering the infection invisible.
Yes.
And it's when they break down that you get the disease. Really nice there.
One final question. What software did you use to draw that graph?
Which one?
The ones that added the, you know, this blood.
These ones. Yeah, that's my... Oh yeah, I did that in R.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Recognizably so.
It's a custom function. Basically, you just you layer down polygons, and you put one polygon on top of the other in terms of...